A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking whether mixed-use buildings can actually work for the people living in them, not just the people designing them on paper. His personal objections are privacy, noise, and traffic, and he's not theoretical about this. He literally lived above a coffee shop and dealt with all three. The question is, are there real design and policy fixes that make sharing a building with commercial tenants viable, or is mixed use always going to be a trade-off where residents lose?
This is the exact tension that urban planning keeps papering over. We celebrate mixed use for reducing car dependency and creating lively streets, but the resident experience is often an afterthought in those planning documents. The street gets the vibrancy, the resident gets the espresso machine at 6 in the morning.
The espresso machine I loved when I was buying coffee, and deeply resented when I was trying to sleep. There's something almost cruel about that arrangement.
It's the urbanist version of loving the concept of dogs until one moves in next door and barks all night. But here's the thesis I want to plant early. These aren't unsolvable problems. They're design failures of the 20th century mixed-use typology. We can retrofit and we can build better from the ground up.
We're not arguing that mixed use is inherently broken. We're arguing that most of it was built wrong.
Or rather, yes, that's the argument. And the evidence is in buildings that do it right.
Let's start with the privacy objection, because it's the one that feels most personal. The specific scenario of bumping into everyone you know on the way to your front door. That's not a hypothetical annoyance. That's the slow erosion of home as a place where you can be unseen.
It's entirely a circulation problem. The single entrance stacked model, where residents walk through the same lobby as commercial customers, share the same elevator bank, and have no transition between public and private, that's the root cause. It forces what architects call a hard boundary at your apartment door, with zero gradation.
Gradation meaning what, exactly?
Think of it as layers of privacy. In a well-designed building, you move from fully public, the street, to semi-public. A residential lobby that only residents and their guests can access, to semi-private, a hallway or courtyard shared with neighbors, to fully private, your apartment. Each layer filters who you might encounter and gives you a moment to choose whether to engage or not. The single entrance model collapses all of that into one door.
You're saying the problem isn't that you see your friends. It's that you see them with no warning, no buffer, no ability to decide whether you're in social mode or not.
And this is where the Tokyo and Vancouver models come in. Both cities have adopted what's called the double-loaded corridor with a separate residential lobby. The building has two entrances at street level, one for commercial, one for residents. The residential entrance might be around the corner or set back from the main street. It's a small thing architecturally, but psychologically it's enormous.
Because you're not walking through a cafe to get to your home.
And the residential lobby itself becomes a threshold space. You step in, you're in your building, not in the commercial zone. Even if it's just a small foyer with mailboxes, it creates that psychological buffer. The Roppongi Hills residential tower in Tokyo does this beautifully. Entirely separate elevator banks for residents and commercial visitors, with a landscaped podium that physically lifts the residential entrance a full story above street level. You take an escalator up through a garden before you even reach the residential lobby.
You're elevated above the chaos before you've even entered your building.
That elevation matters. It's not just physical separation, it's psychological. You've left the street behind. You're in a different world.
Which raises the obvious question. Why does the single-entrance mixed-use building still exist if it creates these problems?
Pure and simple. A separate residential lobby, separate elevator bank, separate circulation, that's more square footage that doesn't generate revenue. Developers maximize leasable commercial space by stacking everything into one core. And for decades, nobody pushed back because the people designing these buildings weren't the people living in them.
There's also a weird ideological assumption baked into a lot of urbanist thinking, which is that more interaction is always better, that bumping into people is inherently good, and if you don't want to bump into people, you're somehow anti-urban.
That's a real blind spot. Jane Jacobs celebrated the ballet of the street, but she was describing voluntary engagement. The shopkeeper, who knows the kids on the block, the eyes on the street, she wasn't arguing that your front door should open directly into a bar patio.
The ballet of the street becomes the mosh pit of the lobby.
Nobody wants to mosh before their morning coffee, which brings us to noise, and this is where I want to get technical.
This is your element.
The core metric here is STC, sound transmission class. It's a rating of how well a building assembly blocks airborne sound. Higher number, better isolation. For a standard interior wall between two residential units, building codes typically require STC 50. That handles normal conversation, television at moderate volume, that sort of thing.
Commercial space below residential is a different beast.
For floor-ceiling assemblies separating commercial from residential, the minimum recommended rating is STC 55. That handles commercial HVA, C-systems, delivery activity, patron chatter, background music. But here's the problem. Many buildings constructed before the year 2000 use assemblies rated at STC 45 or even lower. That's a 10-point gap, and STC is a logarithmic scale.
It's not 10% worse. It's dramatically worse.
A difference of 10 STC points roughly corresponds to a halving or doubling of perceived loudness. So a building with STC 45 is transmitting roughly twice the perceived noise as one with STC 55. And if you drop to STC 40, which some older buildings do, you're basically living above an open window into the commercial space.
I can confirm from personal experience that living above a coffee shop with what I now assume was STC 40 or lower is not charming. The espresso machine at 6 in the morning is not charming. The delivery truck at 5:30 is not charming. The clatter of chairs being stacked at 11 at night is not charming.
Those are all distinct noise types. Impact noise from chairs and deliveries, airborne noise from music and conversation, structure board noise from IHVIC, equipment vibrating through the building frame. Each requires a different mitigation strategy.
What actually works?
Resilient channels. These are metal strips that decouple the drywall from the framing, breaking the vibration path. Double-layer drywall with acoustic sealant. Floating slabs for new construction, where the concrete floor is physically separated from the structural frame by an acoustic mat. Mass-loaded vinyl as a sound barrier layer. And, for impact noise specifically, a thick acoustic underlayment beneath the commercial space's finished floor.
That's a lot of layers.
It's a sandwich of silence. But the key principle is decoupling. You're breaking the physical path that sound travels through. Sound is vibration. If you can prevent the vibration from moving from one material to another, you dramatically reduce transmission. That's why the resilient channel is so effective. It creates a tiny air gap between the drywall and the stud, and that gap is a sound barrier.
There have been code updates that address this.
The 2024 update to the International Building Code, Section 1206, tightened the sound isolation requirements for mixed-use buildings specifically. It now explicitly addresses the commercial-residential interface, requiring impact insulation class ratings alongside STC ratings for floor-ceiling assemblies. Impact Insulation Class, IIC, measures how well the assembly blocks footfall and object impact noise, which is actually the bigger problem in mixed-use settings. You hear the espresso machine less than you hear the chair scraping.
The espresso machine is ambient. The chair scrape is personal.
That's a perfect way to put it. And the IIC requirements were a major gap in older codes. You could have a floor assembly with decent STC, but terrible IIC, and residents would still be miserable because impact noise travels differently through structures.
If you're looking at a mixed-use building, you want to know both numbers.
STC 55 minimum, IIC 50 minimum for new construction. For retrofits, you can often improve both by adding mass-loaded vinyl to the ceiling and installing a floating floor in the commercial space. The 2025 study from the University of British Columbia's School of Architecture found that a $15,000 per unit retrofit, adding acoustic ceiling treatments, secondary glazing on windows, and vestibules at commercial entrances, reduced resident complaints by 40% in a 1970s mixed-use building in Vancouver.
15,000 per unit is not nothing, but it's also not demolish and rebuild money.
It's comparable to a kitchen renovation, and the study noted that this could be financed through energy efficiency programs, since many of the same upgrades that improve acoustics, secondary glazing, better ceiling, also improve thermal performance. You get quieter and warmer in the same project.
Double the comfort, single the disruption.
Which is a compelling pitch for building owners. Now, let's talk about the third piece of the puzzle, traffic. Because the noise from inside the building is only half the story. The noise from outside and the general unpleasantness of living on a busy road is the other half.
This one feels harder to fix, because you can't exactly tell the city to move the road.
No, but you can change the relationship between the building and the road. Urban designers talk about something called the active edge, a buffer zone between the sidewalk and the storefront. 10 to 15 feet of planters, bike racks, seating, awnings. It's a transition space.
Instead of your front door opening onto traffic, it opens onto a landscape strip that happens to face traffic.
That strip does real acoustic work. Planters absorb sound. Awnings deflect street noise upward. Even the visual buffer matters. You're not staring directly at car bumpers from your window. The Pearl District in Portland does this well. Many of the mixed-use buildings there have a 10-foot setback with substantial landscaping, and the ground floor commercial feels like it's part of the street, while the residential entrance feels set apart.
Copenhagen's Nørrebro District has a similar approach, right?
Yes, and they take it further with what they call shared streets. Wooners, a Dutch concept where the street is designed as a shared space with no curb separation between cars, bikes, and pedestrians. Vehicles are forced to slow to walking speed because the design makes it clear they're guests in a pedestrian space, not the other way around.
If the cars are moving at walking speed, the noise profile changes completely.
Engine noise drops, tire noise drops, the need for honking drops. And here's where we have some compelling recent data. In June 2025, Barcelona launched a pilot program in the Eixample district. 12 mixed-use blocks converted to superblocks, with traffic diverted to perimeter roads and speed limits inside the blocks reduced to 10 kilometers per hour. Early data from the pilot shows a 4 decibel reduction in street-level noise and a 22% increase in residents reporting acceptable living conditions.
4 decibels doesn't sound like much.
It's a logarithmic scale. A 3 decibel reduction is roughly a halving of sound energy, so 4 decibels is significant. It's the difference between having to raise your voice to be heard and being able to speak normally with the window open.
That's a quality of life shift, not just a number on a meter.
The 22% satisfaction bump tells you that residents feel it. They may not know what a decibel is, but they know when their home suddenly feels quieter.
We've covered the design solutions for privacy and noise within the building itself. But what about the street outside? That's where traffic becomes the third rail of mixed-use livability. You mentioned superblocks and Wunerfs, but those are street-level interventions. What can the building itself do?
This connects back to the active edge concept, but let me add another layer. The Malmö 1 district in Sweden. It's a mixed-use development where the residential courtyards are raised one full story above street-level commercial. There's a continuous green roof at the commercial level that serves as private outdoor space for residents. You're physically above the traffic. The noise hits the green roof and the commercial facade, not your bedroom window.
The building itself becomes a sound buffer.
And the green roof absorbs sound in a way that hard surfaces don't. Soil, plants, even the irregular surface texture, all of it scatters and absorbs sound waves rather than reflecting them. It's the acoustic equivalent of a soft landing.
Now let's talk about something that feels like a contradiction. Earlier you mentioned that the privacy objection, bumping into friends, is actually a feature of successful mixed use, not a bug. But the listener's experience says otherwise. Where's the line?
This is where Christopher Alexander's concept of gradation of privacy becomes essential. In his book, A Pattern Language, Pattern 127 is called Intimacy Gradient. The idea is that any well-designed building creates a sequence of spaces from most public to most private, and you, the resident, control how far into that sequence a visitor gets.
In a house, it's the street, then the porch, then the living room, then the kitchen, then the bedroom. Each one is a choice point.
And in a mixed-use building, the failure mode is when the sequence collapses to 2 steps, street, then apartment door. There's no porch, no lobby, no courtyard. No space where you can choose to be social or choose to retreat. The building design makes that choice for you, and it always chooses social.
Which is exhausting, even for extroverts.
Especially for extroverts, because they feel obligated to perform. The small lobby, the mailroom, the courtyard. These are what Alexander would call threshold spaces. They're not just circulation, they're decision points. You see your neighbor in the lobby, you can chat for 30 seconds and move on, or you can say you're in a rush and head upstairs. But you get to decide.
As opposed to the cafe scenario, where you're walking through someone else's social space, and you've already been seen before, you even know who's there.
The cafe owner's social space, no less. You're a guest in their establishment every time you come home. That's a weird power dynamic to live inside.
The landlord-tenant relationship is already complicated enough without adding host-guest dynamics to it.
There's a building in Austin I want to mention as a cautionary example. Built in 2019, mixed-use, ground-floor brewpub with a large outdoor patio. The residential lobby opens directly onto that patio. Within 6 months, residents were filing noise complaints, smoke complaints from the kitchen ventilation, and complaints about patrons blocking the entrance. The developer thought they were creating vibrancy. They created a conflict zone. The brewpub eventually installed a glass vestibule around the residential entrance, essentially a soundproof airlock, and reoriented the patio seating away from the lobby door. It helped, but it cost them. The lesson is that these buffers need to be designed in from the start. Retrofitting them is always more expensive and less effective.
We've covered the design layer. Let's talk policy. What can cities actually do to prevent the Austin scenario?
This is where use-based separation within mixed use becomes important. Cities like Seattle and Minneapolis now require that ground floor commercial in mixed use buildings be neighborhood serving rather than destination. Neighborhood serving means cafes, pharmacies, small groceries, dry cleaners, businesses that serve the immediate residents and have limited late night hours. Destination means bars, nightclubs, large restaurants, gyms with amplified music, businesses that draw crowds from outside the neighborhood.
The distinction is about noise profile and traffic generation, not about moral judgment of the business type.
A gym is not inherently bad, but a gym with spin classes at 6 in the morning and amplified bass is a nightmare for the residents above it. The conditional use permit system lets cities say, you can operate this business here, but here are the noise thresholds, here are the operating hours, here are the delivery restrictions.
San Francisco has something similar with their formula retail restrictions.
Right, Planning Code, Section 703.3. It limits chain stores in certain mixed-use buildings. The logic is partly about neighborhood character, but there's an acoustic logic too. Chain stores tend to have standardized delivery schedules, often late at night, with large trucks. A local bookstore gets one delivery a week from a small van. A chain pharmacy gets daily deliveries from a semi. The noise profiles are completely different.
The policy lever isn't just what kind of business, it's what kind of operation.
This is where performance-based zoning becomes the smarter tool. Instead of saying bars are banned, which is a blunt instrument, you say, any commercial tenant must demonstrate that they won't exceed a certain decibel level at the property line, and won't generate more than a certain number of delivery vehicle trips per day. If a quiet wine bar can meet those thresholds, it's allowed. If a loud sports bar can't, it's not.
That shifts the burden from the city guessing which businesses are noisy to the business proving they won't be.
It allows flexibility, the neighborhood gets vibrancy, the residents get protection, and the standard is objective rather than political.
Those policy levers sound great on paper, but they only apply to new construction. What about the millions of people already living in problematic mixed-use buildings? Let's talk retrofits.
The UBC study I mentioned gives us a concrete starting point. $15,000 per unit for acoustic retrofitting that covered mass-loaded vinyl on ceilings, secondary glazing on windows, and vestibules at commercial entrances. 40% reduction in complaints. But there are other levers too. At the policy level, cities can tie retrofit requirements to business license renewals. If a ground floor commercial tenant wants to renew their license, they need to demonstrate compliance with updated noise standards. That creates a natural timeline for upgrades. The building owner doesn't have to retrofit every unit at once. They can phase it in as commercial leases turn over.
The retrofit gets financed by the natural churn of commercial tenancy.
in some cases by green building incentive programs. Many acoustic upgrades, double glazing, better ceiling, added insulation also improve energy efficiency. A building owner can tap into utility rebate programs or green financing to offset the cost. The acoustic benefit is almost a side effect of the energy retrofit.
The silent dividend of going green.
That's a good way to frame it, and there's a precedent for this kind of dual-purpose regulation. Fire safety retrofits were phased in over decades, often tied to permit renewals. Sprinkler requirements didn't happen overnight. They rolled out as buildings underwent major renovations. Acoustic standards could follow the same model.
Let's zoom out for a moment. We've covered privacy through separate entrances and threshold spaces. We've covered noise through SDC ratings, IIC ratings, and acoustic retrofits. We've covered traffic through active edges, superblocks, and woonoofs. But there's an underlying question here that the prompt is really getting at. Can we ever fully resolve the tension between vibrant streets and quiet homes? Or is some friction inevitable and even desirable?
I think some friction is inevitable, and I'm not sure we'd want to eliminate it entirely. The city is fundamentally a place of proximity. The friction is part of what makes it a city rather than a collection of isolated dwellings. The goal isn't to make mixed-use buildings feel like suburban houses. It's to give residents control over when and how they engage with the urban environment.
Control is the operative word. The problem with a bad mixed-use building isn't that it's urban. It's that it takes away your agency. You can't choose to avoid the cafe because the cafe is your lobby. You can't choose to close your window against the noise because the noise is structural vibration coming through the floor.
That's why the gradation concept keeps coming back. Every layer of separation, the separate entrance, the lobby, the STC 55 floor assembly, the setback from the street, every layer is a choice point. You can open your window to the street sounds when you want them and close it when you don't. You can linger in the lobby and chat, or you can walk straight through. The building doesn't force the interaction. It offers it.
A well-designed mixed-use building is one that gives you the option of urban engagement without making it mandatory.
That's the thesis. And it applies at every scale, from the individual unit to the block to the neighborhood. The Barcelona superblock is essentially a gradation of traffic. Fast cars on the perimeter, slow cars inside the block, no cars in the interior courtyards. Each layer filters out more noise and danger.
Let's talk about something that's coming down the pipeline that could change this equation entirely.
Oh, this is interesting.
If autonomous vehicles reduce the need for on-street parking, and that's a big if, but let's assume it happens. The space currently devoted to parked cars could become buffer zones, landscape setbacks, wider sidewalks, bike lanes, outdoor seating. All the things that make the active edge concept work.
The parking lane becomes the buffer lane. And that's not just aesthetic, that's acoustic. A row of parked cars is actually a pretty good sound barrier. It's a solid mass between the traffic lane and the building. If you remove the cars and don't replace them with something, you might make noise worse. But if you replace them with planters and trees and a raised cycle track, you get a better buffer.
The autonomous vehicle transition, if it happens, is an opportunity to redesign the street building interface. But only if cities plan for it now, before the parking minimums get repealed and the space gets absorbed into wider traffic lanes.
The default outcome, if nobody intervenes, is that parking lanes just become driving lanes. More asphalt, higher speeds, more noise. The intentional outcome is that they become green buffers. And that's a zoning and planning choice, not a technology choice.
Which brings us back to the core point of this entire episode. Good outcomes don't happen by accident. They happen because someone designed for them.
The design principles aren't mysterious. We've named them. Gradation of privacy. Performance-based regulation. These are known solutions. The question is whether we have the political will to require them and the financial creativity to fund them.
Let's get practical. If someone is apartment hunting and they're looking at a mixed-use building, what should they actually check? Give me the three filters.
First, is there a separate residential entrance? Walk around the building. If the only way into the residential lobby is through the commercial space or directly adjacent to a busy patio, that's a red flag. Look for a residential entrance that's set back, around the corner, or elevated. What's the STC rating of the floor-ceiling assembly? If it's a new building, ask for the acoustic test results. The developer should have them. If it's an older building, ask what retrofits have been done. If the answer is a blank stare, assume the worst. Is the ground floor commercial neighborhood serving or destination? Look at the hours, the noise profile, the delivery schedule. A cafe that closes at 6 p.m. is a very different neighbor than a bar that closes at 2 a.m. Also look at the HVAC equipment. Is it on the roof or is it ground level near residential windows? Rooftop units are much less intrusive.
Those three filters probably predict 80% of livability outcomes.
I put money on that, and I'd add a bonus fourth, talk to a current resident. Not the one the leasing agent introduces you to. Find someone in the elevator or the mailroom and ask them what it's actually like. You'll learn more in 2 minutes than from any spec sheet.
The spec sheet has never once told someone the espresso machine kicks on at 5:45.
The spec sheet is the official biography of the building. The resident is the memoir.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1912, a shipment of horseshoe crab blood bound for a medical research station on New Zealand's South Island was mistakenly routed through a dairy export depot. A health inspector, convinced the blue liquid was contaminated milk, ordered the entire consignment destroyed. Researchers later estimated the loss set back early bacteriological detection work by nearly a decade.
They destroyed it because they thought it was bad milk.
The most New Zealand sentence ever spoken.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our thanks to producer Hilbert Flumingtob. If you've lived in a mixed-use building and have a hack or a horror story, we want to hear it. Email us at prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We'll feature the best responses in a future episode. Find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. I'm Corn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. The city is loud. Your home doesn't have to be.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.